We're only on the Earth for a very short period of time, relatively speaking. In the grand span of, you know, humans have been around for 400,000 years as Homo sapiens. We're on the Earth for 80 or 90 years. So what are you doing on the Earth? What's your purpose on Earth? Well, is it to make a lot of money, have a lot of yachts and artwork, or is it to do something useful?
If you bought a private island, a private jet, a huge garage of classic cars, and every must-have timepiece in the world, it would cost you about $300 million. My guest today could buy all of those things dozens of times over, but doesn't think it would net you an ounce of happiness. What's up, guys? Welcome to Between Us. This is John Roa. My guest today is the world-renowned financier and philanthropist, David Rubenstein. He famously founded one of the most powerful and prestigious private equity companies in the world, the Carlyle Group, which has netted him billions. What isn't quite as known is that he controls some of the most powerful and important nonprofit organizations in the world, like the Smithsonian Museum, Duke University, the Kennedy Center for Performing Arts, and the Economic Club in Washington. He's also part of the Giving Pledge, along with about 210 other ultra-wealthy folks who have pledged to give the majority of their wealth away. On the show today, we delve a little deeper into how he thinks that one's failure, suffering, and priorities play into making a life worth living. David spends his time investing in art, history, conservation, and preservation, in his mother's scrapbooks, and showing us that all billionaires aren't necessarily evil. This man also can't help but brag about his children and his country. Please welcome David Rubenstein. David Rubenstein, thank you so much for being here. This is a really exciting opportunity for me to talk to somebody who is an absolute legend in the business community. Reading down your resume is one of the most impressive things that I can imagine. The co-founder of the famous Carlyle Group here in the U.S., the chairman of little institutions like the Smithsonian, Council of Foreign Affairs, Kennedy Center, and a huge list of other impressive groups. The host of the David Rubenstein Show, which I've been watching a ton of and absolutely love. It is a very entertaining and insightful look at people like Richard Branson, Mark Cuban, Melinda Gates, Bill Gates, and my old boss, Mark Benioff. An author of multiple books and a philanthropist, and you've committed to giving away over half your wealth to that cause, and a billionaire. You asked an interesting question to Jeff Bezos on the David Rubenstein Show about him being the richest man in the world and what that title meant to him. Of the titles that I just read, which ones matter most to you and why?
Well, the one you didn't mention was American citizen. So I came from a modest family, blue collar background. My grandparents came over from Europe, and being a U.S. citizen is the greatest title you can have. So I'm very committed to doing what I can to remind people of the history and heritage of this country. So that's probably the proudest one that I have. And I guess second would be probably father. I have three children and they all seem to be in reasonable shape, though, as you may know, if you're a parent, it's always challenging raising children. But of the titles you mentioned beyond citizen and father, I'm proud of a number of them. I love the Kennedy Center. I loved and admired John Kennedy. And to be the chair of the Kennedy Center is great. I love foreign policy. The chair of the Council on Foreign Relations is a terrific thing. And I also was chairman of the Duke University Board of Trustees, and that was my alma mater. And so I really enjoyed that. And the Smithsonian is an extraordinary organization. So being the chair of that's been quite impressive as well. And something I enjoy. But, you know, at this point in my life, maybe like you, I only am doing things I really want to do. I don't have to do anything.
Right.
So everything I'm doing, I enjoy and I'm really happy.
And when did that freedom enter your life? At what age, at what stage of life did you feel that sensation of saying, I can actually dedicate my time, energy, money, et cetera, to only what I care about, what I love?
Well, when I grew up, I didn't have any money. And so when you don't have any money, you don't think about it because you don't really, you know, think that you're going to get rich. And so I didn't really feel deprived. I had two parents that gave me unconditional love, and that was probably all that I expected. And I didn't expect to do anything that was that prominent. But when I did get into the business world, and it was successful after about 10 or 15 years, and I became wealthy by the standards of normal human beings, not by Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, but by normal human beings, I realized that I had more money than I really needed. And so I decided to get involved in giving it away. But when you have the freedom of not having to work or not having to do anything, obviously it's embracing and you can do what you want. So I now am fortunate that I have the ability to do anything I want. I'm unfortunate, and I'm now 71 years old. So almost exactly twice your age. And so, you know, I would give up every penny I have if I could be 1 year younger or 10 years younger. But, you know that that's not possible. So I'm doing the best I can to make certain that my brain doesn't give out, my body doesn't give out before I get the stuff done that I want to do.
In that reflection on the comment that you just made about time, right, which is what you hear from a lot of people who have dedicated their lives to not the goal of achieving wealth, but that's a byproduct, right? And they look back and say, I might have done some things differently. Do you have that conversation with yourself of I might have done this or that differently in that spirit of time and getting it back?
Well, it's tempting to say, as Frank Sinatra would say, I've had regrets, but too few to mention. On the other hand, I'm Jewish, and therefore I have lots of regrets. I'm always looking back and saying, why did I give up my stock in Amazon?
Right.
Why did I not make the initial investment I could have done at the ground floor of Facebook? I made a lot of mistakes. But in the end, I have to look back and say, look, I got very lucky in life. And now I don't really have any regrets. I wish I'd done some things differently, but everybody does. So I just, want now to live as long as I can in as healthy a fashion as I can. When COVID came along, I realized that even though I have great doctors and I've access to great hospitals, COVID is something that could kill somebody like me relatively quickly.
Right.
So I decided to stay as healthy as I could and then ultimately give money more away to healthcare related things, and also to get my bucket list in order and try to get my bucket list over with.
Can I ask you what your bucket list is?
Well, doing this podcast was one of them. now that I have checked that one off, but ultimately to give away the bulk of my money while I'm alive into things that are of interest to me. That's one of them. And then, I visited most places in the world, but probably spending more time with my children. It's interesting. I have three children. All of them have MBAs and all of them are pretty much in the investment world. When you're raising children, you say, I'm too busy to deal with them. When they move out of the house and they have their own lives, they're too busy to deal with you.
Yeah.
And now, I'm always saying, hey, maybe they'll call me today. You never know, but maybe they will, maybe they won't. So if they don't, I call them. But the legacy that we all leave in the end, the things that we did in our life, but to some extent for people that have children, one of your legacies is your children.
Yeah. Well, that's the cat in the cradle
absolutely.
Issue, right? Yeah.
Gary Chapin.
Absolutely. The definition of success, I'm sure that's changed throughout your life. And I'd like to hear some stages where that has been different and especially what it is now.
Well, when you're growing up, you want your peers to think you're good. You're a good athlete. You're a good student or whatever. And then to some extent, you probably want your parents to at least not be upset with you, if not be happy with you.
Right.
As you get older, you realize that parents have really done a lot for you. And so the success that I felt for a number of years was that my mother was actually proud of what I had done. Not that I'd made a lot of money. She didn't care about that, but that I was giving away the money and helping in philanthropic ways. And so when she died a few years ago at 86, she left some scrapbooks, and all the scrapbooks were just the things that I had done to give away money and help other people. None of the scrapbooks about the money I'd made or other honors. So it tells you what she thought was valuable. And I kind of regarded pleasing my mother and my father as one of my areas of success. Now, not having my children be embarrassed about me is probably one area of success. Maybe they're not that embarrassed. But also, you obviously want critical acclaim for stuff you've done. So I wrote a book a year ago. It was pretty well received. I have another one out now. And that's sort of being well received. So you enjoy that. But, you want people to think that you're doing something useful with your life.
Sure. Which you obviously have and are. And I find that amazing. So I want you to try to offer us some perspective. I feel like people have lost a lot, or maybe not lost, but at least changed their perspectives on the world, on themselves, on our country in 2020. This has been... hopefully, even by everyone's standards, including somebody with much experience as yourself, this has been one hell of a year. And there's been incredible levels of divisiveness. There's been incredible macro and microeconomic effect that's been taking place. If you sat down with somebody you care a lot about, be it your own kid, and they just said, I'm feeling a bit lost. What can you offer me in terms of how I should think about a year like 2020? What would you say to them based on just your wealth of wisdom and experience that you've accumulated? Yeah.
Well, 2020 has been a difficult year for the United States because so far we've lost 190,000 Americans due to a virus that nobody could have anticipated a year ago. We've also, I think, done some things that many countries around the world that are allies of ours have not been in favor of. We also have had the racial riots and other related things in the country that's been not healthy and helpful. So it's been a year that people will never forget. And I don't think it will change when the vaccine comes. I interviewed earlier today the FDA commissioner, and of course he couldn't say when the vaccine was going to come, but reading between the lines, I don't think people really have full access to a vaccine till the middle of next year.
Right.
There'll be some people getting it early in the year, but probably the average person middle of next year. So we're going to live with this pandemic for about a year or so, but it's going to change us. And put it in this perspective. The Industrial Revolution occurred over about a 100-year period. The Internet Revolution maybe over a 20-year period of time. This revolution, the pandemic revolution, over 1 year. Mm. So for in the future, you're not going to have to get on a plane to go visit people. I'm not going to have to get on a plane to go visit people so much. We're going to do it by Zoom. And shortly, Zoom will have 3D virtual reality. You'll probably be able to smell things and other kinds of things over Zoom. It'll be completely different than it has been. And so therefore, it's changed the world in just a very short period of time.
Right.
Also, people are much more focused on their health than they were before because people are afraid of their own mortality more than they were before.
The whole Zoom work from home virtual life kind of thing, does that excite you or does that depress you?
Both.
Okay.
It excites me because I don't have to go to Abu Dhabi or Singapore every time I want to have a meeting with somebody in Abu Dhabi or Singapore. It's a long way to go.
Yeah.
On the other hand, sitting in your house for 9 months is a little complicated. So I've been basically in this house. I've owned this house for 30 years. I've spent more time in the last 6 months in this house than I did in the previous 30 years.
Yeah.
And so, how many times can you go from one room to another room and not feel like you're, trapped?
Yeah.
So it's a plus and it's a minus. But to be very serious, Zoom has changed our lives and Zoom equivalents, because we are now going to do much more this way. Remember, when the internet first came, we were amazed about what you could do over the internet. But now with Zoom and its equivalent, we don't need to go visit people so much. Now, human contact is wonderful, and social interchange is great, and having meals with other people is great. But I think Zoom can accomplish a lot, and so therefore, in many ways, people like you or me may be more productive this way than otherwise.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Your show, the David Rubenstein Show, I absolutely love, and I was saying it earlier. You're very, very funny on it. It's very entertaining, but it's also incredibly insightful. And you've had, everyone from top to bottom on that show. I've been binging the episodes all day before I talk to you. So I feel like I have a good sense for you. What are some of the most interesting tidbits that you've learned on that show from your guests, either pieces of advice or wisdom or insight, or just what really stands out to you and from who?
Well, no matter how famous somebody is, they're a human who has their insecurities, has their flaws, has their interests that may be different than other people's interests and so forth. But everybody has a story about overcoming failure, how they were not as successful as they wanted to be, how they persevered through that. Everybody has some kind of sense of humor, and everybody likes to kind of tell you something humorous about themselves that kind of shows them to be not this famous person, but somebody that's an average person. I don't know, whether if I'd interviewed Julius Caesar or Napoleon, they would have been humble and made jokes about their failures in life.
Right.
But it's in the current world that we live in, humility, with a few exceptions, is generally thought to be a good virtue. And many people I've interviewed have humility, maybe deservedly so, because they just really believe in being humble. Some people might feign it a bit. But I do think that you learn from people that they have, the men put their pants on one leg at a time. They all have their mistakes. They all, always worried about certain things. So, and a lot of people feel they got lucky.
Sure. Yeah. I heard Jeff say that, Bezos say that. And it's always interesting to hear somebody at that level of success and wealth, even use the L word, the luck word, because it seems a little bit, maybe overly humble or something of the sort.
Well, look, Jeff Bezos' situation is extraordinary when you think about it. He's a very smart guy. Was valedictorian of his class in high school in Miami. Goes to Princeton, wants to be a nuclear physicist, I believe it was. And he got there and realized he wasn't as smart as he thought. And in fact, there was one very difficult thing he talked about in the interview where he realized he couldn't solve some nuclear physics related thing. He went down the hall to some person, and that person who's the genius in the class solved it. So everybody said, uh-oh, who is this genius that Jeff Bezos had to go solve a problem with? Well, it turns out he's a one-man consulting firm in California now. So this guy who was the man that was the genius, right, you know, Jeff Bezos became the richest man in the world. This other guy's got a one-man consulting firm. So it just shows you can't predict. And I often say in my new book, I talk about this. You divide people's lives into one-third, one-third, one-third. The first third is when you're getting educated and formed. Very often, in your high school, for example, you would have seen somebody who was first in the class, student body president. Maybe in some other classes or other schools, there would have been a Rhodes Scholar or a Supreme Court clerk or White House fellow. These are the superstars. But very rarely do they turn out to be the leaders in the second, third, or third third of life.
Right.
Because they fizzle out, they're bored, they don't want to work as hard. It's the people that maybe weren't the superstars, like I was not, early on, who just kept working hard, failed, and learned from stuff. So I don't know whether you were first in your class or you're the student body president. But now, clearly, if you go back to your high school class, you're probably the most successful person in your class. And would people have predicted that then? Who knows?
Definitely not. I squeaked through almost at the bottom of the class through high school. I got kicked out of two colleges for bad grades before I graduated from a third. So to say the least, that would not be the prediction. And but you're right. And I think that that's really interesting. Now, you've had to pick winners as an investor, right, in private equity for decades.
Right.
How did this knowledge come into picking winners? When you met an entrepreneur or a founder or a CEO, how did you change the bases of looking at a resume versus this kind of human capital component you're describing?
Well, you mean in terms of picking investments?
Picking winners, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we make a lot of mistakes, so not everything works out. But generally, in the private equity world, you're looking for a concept that works, a good management team, a business that has some barriers to entry, something that's proprietary, but we make mistakes all the time. As I say, we thought Amazon wasn't going anywhere. and so, you know, sometimes deals look wonderful. And every investment committee, every deal sounds like it's going to be the next Amazon.
Of course.
And then when you go look at that thing of 1 or 2 years later, you say, well, we made this mistake, we made that mistake. So,
yeah. But what about the human component? Because if you saw two resumes and one was that, you know, Harvard and cum laude and everything else, and one was me, right? That, you know, fumble, starting in this second or third. Do you use that in your bases to make a decision for the potential success? Do you kind of incorporate those human elements?
Okay. If you have somebody that went to Harvard College, summa cum laude, Rhodes Scholar, Harvard Business School, Baker Scholar, everything you want, that person is probably going to do reasonably well. But that person is not going to be the person who turns out to be Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, or Steve Jobs, because they haven't suffered in life. You have to suffer. You have to fail. You have to have real complications in your life. So that person would probably be a good person to run a company. But if you wanted somebody that's going to build a company from scratch, you want somebody that dropped out of a college, somebody that has come up from has pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, somebody that really wants to make a name for himself and is worried about nothing like prestige or credentials, is only worried about proving this concept works. Take Steve Jobs. He probably went to college for 1 week, maybe even one class, and had a lot of eccentricities, and he turned out to build the company that's the most valuable company in the world.
Yep.
So who would have predicted it?
So you said your three kids are all in the investment world, MBAs, clearly very intelligent, following in your footsteps. Had one of them, you know, been kicked out of high school or didn't graduate college, how would you have reacted as a parent?
Well, as you get older, you are more willing to recognize that raising children is difficult. As Jackie Kennedy said, if you mess up raising your children, nothing else in life matters. It's very difficult to be a parent and to raise children. And if you're wealthy, raising children is even more complicated because your kids know that you're not going to throw them in the street most likely.
Right.
And so they can fall back on you if that possible. You know, if my kids turned out to be terrible, I would say, well, I didn't do a good job. It's my fault. But generally, I think I'm pretty happy with them. And I did it in part, not with myself, by myself. Obviously, my wife, I had a major role in it as well, maybe a bigger role. But what happened was we didn't give our kids staggering sums of money. We didn't try to flaunt our lifestyle. I tried to hide my worth for a long time so they wouldn't read about it. And you know, I gave them enough money to live on, but not enough so that they didn't have to do anything.
Right.
And I emphasize the importance of hard work and a good education.
Absolutely. So I'm going to speak to kind of younger people. There's a lot of younger listeners to this podcast, even that make me look like, out of the game, because there's a lot of, aspiring entrepreneurs, especially, who are listening and thinking to themselves, maybe they're in the middle of running a company. Maybe they're aspiring to. What messages do you have, based on this, tremendous, again, just experience and wisdom you have for the younger generation of up and comers, of doers, of the hustlers that you're describing right now?
Okay. Well, in reading my book, I talk about the important things that for success and leadership. And let me just mention a few. One, don't be afraid to fail. Don't accept conventional wisdom, because conventional wisdom is almost always going to be telling you not to do something. Three, persistence, persistence, persistence. When people tell you not to do something, that doesn't mean that they're right. They may be wrong. You got to persist. You have to believe in what you're doing. You don't have to think you're fooling people, but you have to believe in it. You also have to continuously learn, read. Educate yourself, because the world's always changing. Also, try to share the credit. Ronald Reagan said famously, there's no limit to what humans can accomplish or they're willing to share the credit. I also think you have to learn how to communicate. Mm. And to be a leader and to build a company, you have to have people follow you. You have to have people want to work for you. How do you do that? Well, you can learn how to speak better. You can learn how to write better. But the most important thing is leading by example. If you tell your people work hard, you have to work hard. If you tell your people to do something, you do it yourself. So that's very important. I also think integrity is important and honesty. And I also think humility is important. Yeah. Now, obviously, you can become president of the United States and not be humble. And we've seen that from time to time.
We've seen that.
But, and again, I don't think Napoleon was probably particularly humble.
Right.
It'd be my guess, but I didn't really know him. But, if you think about Abe Lincoln, you can't see Abe Lincoln running around saying, I won the Civil War by myself. He probably wouldn't have said that.
Right.
But I think that humility is important. So when you meet with Warren Buffett, he's a very humble guy. You meet with Phil Knight, he's a very humble guy. A lot of these people have accomplished a lot of things, but they say it was luck, and I don't really even take the credit myself. That's what I think entrepreneurs should do. Think about those kind of things.
The kind of next generation, let's call them the millennials, they get a lot of flack, right? And a lot of people look down at them as less, less right. hardworking, less aspirational. Do you have this that point of view? Do you share that point of view that we might be at a lesser work ethic, at a lesser level of grind than, let's say, when you were coming up?
I would say for the last 5 to 10,000 years, a generation my age has been saying the younger generation is not going anywhere.
Right.
George Washington's father used to tell him, your generation is not going to make it. You're not going to make it. You guys aren't working hard. So that's always the case.
Yeah.
I don't think millennials are any worse than any other younger generation. In my view, they have some features that my generation didn't have. One, they are really committed to ESG principles. They're really committed to improving the environment. They're really committed to racial harmony and less discrimination. I think they're really committed to making certain that there's a real equal opportunity. I think much more than my generation was committed to. And I think money isn't the only measure of success for these people. They want to do things that change the world. So I wouldn't disparage millennials in any way. I think every older generation always disparages the younger generation.
Sure.
And that's been going on since the dawn of history.
No, that makes a lot of sense. The last question I have for you, David, is you're down there near our nation's capital. We have a big couple of months ahead of us. And you obviously, I'm sure, are involved in conversations and discussions that the rest of us are not. And so help, especially for younger folks, help to frame the importance of the coming months we're going to have until November 4th. And anything that you think might not be a common or kind of typical narrative as we enter the election here and what people should be thinking about.
Well, many people have died fighting for your right to vote. So vote once, not twice, but vote once, however you want to do it. Secondly, try to get educated about what the issues are so that you can know intelligently what you're voting for or voting against. Third, try to get involved in influencing your members of Congress or other representatives about what you think is appropriate. And they do respond and they do listen. And try to make the world a better place. We're only on the earth for a very short period of time, relatively speaking. In the grand span of, humans have been around for 400,000 years as Homo sapiens. We're on the earth for 80 or 90 years. So what are you doing on the earth? What's your purpose on earth? Well, is it to make a lot of money, have a lot of yachts and artwork, or is it do something useful? The hardest thing to do in life is to be personally happy. It's the most elusive thing. Obviously, many people struggle with being personally happy. My view is that the best way to achieve personal happiness is to help other people in some way. People that help other people are more likely to be happy than people that just have a lot of money and to tell people how great they are and how much money they have. That doesn't buy personal happiness. So as Thomas Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is what life is about. And if you want to pursue happiness, help other people. And as millennials, you have the resources and I think the knowledge and the drive to do that.
That's fantastic. David Rubenstein, thank you so much for your time. It's an absolute pleasure. You are an incredibly inspirational guy to talk to and read about. Your books are on order. I'm already obsessed with your show. I'll continue that. And best of luck with all of the dreams that you've put out for yourself on the bucket list.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks, David.
Bye.
Bye. And there we have it. At the end of the day, it does feel good to have a billionaire tell you that the class president and all the popular kids are probably not the most likely to be as successful as you in adulthood. We're only on Earth for a very short period of time. We have to make use of that time. And the best way to achieve that personal happiness is to help others. No amount of money can buy that. I really enjoyed that chat. David's an incredibly inspirational person, and I can tell you that after our chat, it's led me to think about my own personal pursuits and philanthropy in a very different way. For my part, I had two major takeaways from this conversation. First, there can be a healthy balance of capitalistic and philanthropic pursuits when your intentions are real and you're genuinely a good person. We often conflate the two and think that you can either be ultra successful or go out and help the world. And this fallacy is based on many ultra rich people who are awful human beings. But David is the exception that proves the rule. Secondly, and especially in this very charged political landscape, capstoned by this nail-biting presidential election, it is really good to hear somebody with a lot of Washington experience reframe what it means to be a patriot and remind us why we should all be so proud to be an American. This is something that I often forget. So for our listeners, there are two books I want everyone to go out and buy. The first is David Rubenstein's book, How to Lead. It's brilliant, and it talks about the wisdom that he's gleaned after interviewing tons of the world's most successful people, like Barack Obama and Melinda Gates. It's a true must-read. The second is my memoir, A Practical Way to Get Rich and Die Trying, where I talk about my story as a tech entrepreneur dealing with mental health, burnout, and ultimately, success. You can find both books on Amazon and all online booksellers. You can find me on social media at John Roa. That's J-O-H-N-R-O-A. And the podcast is at @betweenus_pod. This podcast is produced by Jam Street Media. Thank you to Maddie Stout, Amanda Rosenberg, and Casey Franco for running with me on this episode. We'll see everybody next Tuesday. Be safe out there.